My wife happens to be one of them.
I'll have 12.
And it's only because she
gets you a little cup.
I can say something
really inappropriate, but the mic's on now.
Such a great.
Sometimes I just like to do this all day long. I just come in here on Saturday and just do this.
There's video. Yeah,
just kidding. Okay, we're going to call the House Land Use Committee to order.
Okay.
Hi, everyone.
Good welcome. Welcome. Today's Bill Kennemer Day, Representative Bill Kennemer Day at the Land Use Committee, although we may only have his pleasure of his company for a little bit. So could you and your colleague, Representative Reardon, and I've got to call you Mr. Lavender until I remember the name. I'm so sorry. Jim Durking, would you please join us? And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 3439.
Thanks for the question.
Okay. We're going to let Jeff go first because he's on a timeline. He's
okay.
Get back to his other committee.
Rep Jim.
Great.
Rep Jeff.
Yeah. Chair Climate Committee. Early last summer, I was talking to you, Jeff Reardon, representative for House District 48. Thank you for allowing me to speak this afternoon. Last summer, when I was getting into my new line of work here, I talked to a very experienced gentleman, been in building about 40 years. He said, well, never speak up unless you have unique knowledge about a topic. And so I try to subscribe to that. And but in this case, I do. I know Mr. Durking through his son, who was a student of mine at David Douglas High School a number of years ago. Through that experience, we actually went out as a marketing class and visited the farm, the Lavender Farm, and did a little marketing project for Mr. Durking. So that's how we got to know each other. And so I don't want to drag this out, but and just want to say that this farm, if you haven't been out there, it really is a place to visit. It's what's really interesting is that he's using existing buildings. He's maximizing use of the property for agricultural pursuits. He's growing lavender where there used to be chicken farms and rabbit hutches, and using those existing buildings. So it's a beautiful place. And I think it's interesting. It sounds like he's doing this high-volume manufacturing business. He's bringing in, you know, like 50-gallon drums of material, rebottling those. And so it really sounds like there's more going on than there is. But really, the point of that statement is there's not like this high volume of traffic. So in my visits out there, what I saw was something that seemed very consistent with the farming and agricultural uses of that land. So again, it's really a better use than it had been in the past. He's worked. His son Orion is involved in that business, so it's become very much a family business. And again, I think it's a farm. It's what it is, and this side business necessary to sustain their existence. So I would hope that you would give him every consideration possible. And any questions, Steve?
I know you have to leave, so why don't we do questions for Representative Reardon now, if anybody has any. Hey, wow.
All right, thank you.
That is not usual.
Okay.
To get out of the Land Use Committee without some technical question about commercial use in conjunction with... I'm just kidding. Yeah. Okay.
For Representative Jeff, appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, Bill Kennemer, State Representative, District 39. And I'm here with my constituent, Jim Durking of Oregon Lavender Farms. And I appreciate the opportunity to talk a little bit about the bill that is before you, because we've run into a little complication. But I'd like, if I could, if you'd indulge me, I'd like to tell you a little interesting story. It was approximately in 2000 or sometime shortly after Mr. Durking bought the farm that he kept inviting his county commissioner to come out and take a peek at it. and his county commissioner kept claiming he was busy and making excuses. But eventually he was persistent, and he said, come out and see what I'm trying to do. And so around 2000, I made a visit out to the Lavender Farm, or the beginnings of the Lavender Farm, and followed the directions about 10, 15 miles out of town and go down this paved road, because this used to be a rabbit and poultry facility. And so the county had paved the road right to the property. And then drove down this driveway and talked to some folks, and there were kind of some semi-rundown buildings and an old house, and asked them, I was there to see Jim. And they said, well, he's down below working on the irrigation pond. And go down to the end of the road and take a left and follow it down the side hill down to the pond. And so that's what I did. And went down there and found Jim was working on this pond. It looked to me kind of like a southern bayou. It was a kind of a swampy place, and he was up to his eyeballs in dirt, and it was a mess and wet and all kinds of things down there. And it turns out that they used to dump the manure over the sides and it'd run down the hill, and there were a few issues with the way the land had been cut and stuff. And we talked for a while, and I was very intrigued with his ideas. And then, fortunately, I'd taken my four-wheeler, and I was able to four-wheel back up the hill and get out of there. And Cherry had gone with me, and as we're leaving, I'm looking at a bunch of rocks out in the fields and tree stumps. And the place is a mess. And I remember turning to Cherry and saying, you know, I'm afraid Jim's probably over his head on this one. Because it looked like a pretty unlikely thing to make a comeback. And there are all these buildings there, but they're contaminated with drug labs. Yeah. And this is a really derelict piece of property. And it's been exciting to see Jim come in and have a dream and transform this property. It's a pleasure to go out and walk around it. He collected those rocks and put them in a pond up above. And there's a big knoll there, and he's got a gazebo up there. And then you can sit up there and look over the lavender fields and the ponds are out on Mount Hood. You should have a piece of information like this that shows quite a picturesque setting. And he has been gradually putting this thing together. We've had a number of hurdles when I was county commissioner. And it's just been progressing beautifully. And each year there's a lavender festival, and people go out there. I would invite you this July. You might want to take a run out there. It's a wonderful jaunt into the country. Families are there. Young kids are playing in the pond, getting wet. And you look off at 25 acres of lavender blowing in the breezes. It looks like some of the finest wheat fields that are a little different color you've ever seen in your life. An amazing thing. But there is an unhappy person out of Florida who's filed a suit and raised some complications about what's occurring here. And so we were talking with the county, seeing if there wasn't a way to work it out. And it was at the county's recommendation that we created this bill. We thought we should bring it to the legislature and see if we can't get a fix here. A couple of other things to say about it is, not only is there a great festival, but Jim has between 25 and 35 employees, so this has become a significant ranch. And you know, in the Oregon City area, we're big into nurseries and stuff, so his has fit right in there. And also, he's been able to clean up these barns, repair them, get them looking decent, and provide jobs for people. And part of what I like is we're talking about a value added here. This is a value added product. He's created a marketplace too that's rather amazing. It's now involves imports from as many as 45 different countries and a number of other states, and yet it's low volume in traffic because the internet allows you to do business in different ways these days. And he refines these products. He has a small distillery. Mr. Chairman, it's not a beer distillery. It's for herbal products. and he is able to refine his products and then market those literally worldwide. So it's a special niche. It's an exciting thing about transforming the derelict mess, which frankly, and I grew up on farms, by the way, so I've seen a few stumps and trees and this and chicken and chicken ranches, and I thought this was a pretty hopeless mess, but it's really a beautiful place, and I think you ought to consider getting out there. I think it's an integrated business now that is a value added, and you know, instead of sitting with tree stumps to China, I think we've figured out a way to harvest some of what's going on around the world and make it work right here locally. So that's sort of my introduction. Oh, and the farm and the building date back to 1970, so that's the basis for the bill, is we're going back in time to establish the precedent there. So I want to make that point as well. So this is a historic farm, and Jim is now going to share some of the details and some more information. And of course, we're always eager to have your questions. And I just think, you know, this is a business I'd like to see stay in Oregon instead of go away and continue employing 25 to 35 local folk.
Should we
continue on?
Yeah. Welcome, Jim, and please give us your name for the record and tell us a little bit about your operation.
Great. Thank you, Chair Clem and committee members. My name is James Dierking, and my address is 20949 South Harris Road, Oregon City, Oregon. I really appreciate the opportunity to share the story. I sent over some supportive information that goes into quite a bit of detail, showing you pictures of what I characterize as the before and after. As Representative Kenemer expressed to you, he wasn't the only one who had a heart attack when they came out to visit the farm. One good friend of mine broke out in a cold sweat and was seriously disturbed. It was in that bad of repair. There are approximately 150,000 square foot of buildings. As Representative Kenemer was saying, it goes back, we've documented in aerial maps for the majority of all the buildings to that time. However, it actually went back to around 1963 when it was established as the Logan Egg Farm. It was later that it was expanded into a distribution facility for Carnation when they acquired it. And after they had polluted the groundwater table, they ceased operations and the property was sold off. It was originally a couple hundred acres, but was divided into several different parcels. The parcel that we're talking about is about 90 acres. Subsequent to that time, they started some rabbit raising operations, which included raising rabbits for the meat and for the furs and so forth. Those operations were not successful. They had obtained conditional use permits at that point for it, and by the time that we'd found it in 1999, it had been more or less vacant, except for, as Representative Kenemer was saying, there was a drug lab, but there was also had been chop shops and cockfights and the history of this property. It was quite a public nuisance. So to make this story a little shorter, we worked hard for 14 years, brought to bear my background in the past in home building and construction, and we went through and we literally renovated the entire farm. That included the fields. It included propagating lavender, learning how to distill, building our equipment. We were very fortunate. Some of the contacts that we've made in the botanical trades included a French company that started the lavender entire industry in France, the great-grandfather. They have been mentors to us, and they've tried to give us a vision of what we can do to not just have a 25-acre lavender farm, but to actually grow a lavender industry. I wish I could tell you that was something that could happen in a few years. We feel like we've accomplished a tremendous amount. But if you want to end up with thousands of acres of lavender, it takes generations. Mm-hmm. So part of our vision for this facility is that it will be used for as a mother distillery for developing a lavender industry. Now, I went to France and visited a number of different operations there. Two of them that I went and visited were very similar to ours, and this is part of where we've gotten the vision. We're distributing the botanical produce of perhaps a million acres of agriculture around the world. A lot of agricultural operations distribute in order to support their primary agricultural practice. And so we're replicating something that has existed prior to Oregon's land use and exists in France. And my understanding is these uses are actually allowed outright. And what we're looking for here is just to, whether it be conditional use permit or act of the legislature, we just want to make it so that it's a lawful use. After reviewing the befores and afters and the information that we've submitted to you, we hope that you conclude, as we do, that there's no question that our use is supportive of our primary agricultural use, and that it's supportive of other agricultural uses, and that the real question here is whether or not making an exception to the statute is the right thing to do in terms of making a decision. And in this particular case, we've had difficulties in terms of land use with the county, and it's one of those Lifetime movie type stories, but we're involved in some litigation with someone, and in defense of their actions, and it's multi-state litigation, they filed a land use complaint with the county and asked for a cease and desist, their intent being to put us out of business. So the origins of this is that the county did issue a cease and desist. We said, please come out and see what we're doing here. We're a valuable part of the community. And they looked at it and said, okay, we don't know how to solve this problem. We don't see that we can do a conditional use permit. We don't see that we can do a reasons exception. We want you to take this to the legislature. We said, yes, we will do that. And that's why I'm here today. And so I'm asking you to consider carefully and weigh the, I understand the policy of not making exceptions and further patchworking the statute. In this particular case, I would argue that the greatest good is to put yet one more patch, that it's not going to undermine the land use statute. You know, I notice in the statute there's the fireworks stand that's in there. It's a sole exception. We don't have fireworks stands on ag land all over the state. Our facility is relatively unique. We don't believe that in passing this particular legislation that it's going to result in legacy facilities like it being used for the same use. If there were such facilities, it would be in the public interest. If you have any questions, I'd appreciate the opportunity to.
Mr. Chairman,
I may interrupt.
Yeah.
And we have dash one amendments in an effort to more carefully limit this. We figured a way to make the limit quite small so that we don't have the problem of really establishing a significant precedent. And I think it's important to make that point. We're trying, you know, I don't think we're going to see the propagation of a whole lot of lavender farms all over the state or whatever, but it will continue to make this a profitable venture. The other thing that I think is also of interest is we hope for agriculture to not only survive, but to some degree increase. And there are adjoining derelict properties, and in due course, there's some hope by Mr. Deer King that some of these additional properties, which would allow a little bit more in the way of agricultural use, and he would follow the reclamation procedures that he used with this land to add some additional agriculture producing land over time. But they're both market and time and money considerations that will control that. But I thought I had to add that. Thank you for letting me add.
Thank you. So I'll just ask a couple of questions. Do you have, not necessarily with you, but do you have some correspondence with the county that you might be able to furnish us, or is it all verbal?
I do have some documentation of our arrangement with regard to the legislative.
Yeah, that would help. I found that, and again, they're not here, when the county doesn't show up at these hearings, sometimes we try and find them in the hall and make them come in here, and they don't want to come because they don't, it's not the specific county. So I was thinking about going and finding the guy and making him come in here, but that probably wouldn't do us any good. So if you could just give us some information, if you have some back and forth, because I'd like to talk to them about why this wouldn't be considered a commercial use in conjunction with some farming activities, what they're thinking. Things like implement stores are, and they're just selling other people's equipment, that kind of thing. So anyway, I'm kind of curious. I'm also find it interesting. I assume that you got building permits when you did things from the county, and they didn't apparently notice while they were issuing you all their building permits that you were building things on this farm. So that's the kind of questions I'd ask the county if they were here, but they're not, I don't believe.
Good question.
So if you could give us some information, that would help. Because we get, people send them up here, blame us, and sometimes it gets resolved. We had one last week here that we believe is now resolved at the county level when they said no until we had the hearing, and now mm-hmm. I think they're saying yes in Hood River County. But I can't promise that kind of outcome here or not. I just would love to have whatever information we can get that shows some history back and forth on, a complaint's been filed, blah, 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 what your response was, what their response was, that kind of paper trail if possible.
I can do that. Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? Okay. So since I've got you, tell us just a little bit more about what else comes in from around the world and what do you do with it besides your acreage?
Our focus is on essential oils.
Yeah.
We also bring in jojoba oil from Israel, would be an example. We bring in a lot of oils from India, 45 different countries. We'd like to think that we have the largest selection of essential oils anywhere in the world. That's been the focus of our business. With that being said, we also, out at the farm, make herbal extracts out of herbs that we grow. It's a extraction using alcohol.
Yeah.
And we make those out of herbs that we grow at the farm as well as herbs that we grow elsewhere. Not all herbs grow well in Oregon. You always want to source where the best material comes from. So we sell to a lot of small natural product manufacturers. We sell to a lot of farms who are doing value added. Our customers are in the United States, in Oregon, and worldwide. About 20% of our sales at this point are international.
Okay.
These oils would include peppermint, cinnamon. We buy quite a bit of peppermint oil from Oregon and Washington.
So one question, you may or may not even be able to answer this, but if there hadn't been existing buildings on there, do you think you would have built the premises to bring in the other stuff in town where you might have more of a retail location, or because you had your own mixing and distilling too, it's just not really worth it to do that?
I probably wouldn't have been able to do the agricultural operation, being able to use the workforce and terms of accounting, marketing, the whole works, the synergy is absolutely incredible. I advanced the notion that this is a great thing because it was an existing legacy facility. I couldn't genuinely say that I would, say this is a good model to put on farmland. It would really require a lot of siting, and it's only because it was a legacy facility and was a public nuisance. You know, what's significant here is that it had been on the market for almost a decade, and it was in such great state of disrepair, and as Bill said,
you were crazy enough to buy it.
Yeah.
But it's apparently worked out.
Yeah. I think that can't be overrated. I mean, this is now a picturesque place. I mean, if you really want to have a nice time some weekend in July, honest to goodness, put the family or your friends in a car and drive out there and look them up on the website so you get the right date. What is it going to be, July?
13th and 14th.
13th and 14th. And, I mean, you'll be astounded. I mean, it just blows you away. There's this magnificent framing of Mount Hood. It's as good as it gets in Clackamas County, and it gets mighty good there. And this lavender field of 25 acres, and it's so much fun. You see these kids running through the field, and more typically the moms, but some moms and dads are out there, and they've got their scissors, and they're snipping little treasures as they walk along. I mean, you know, and good food and good people, even some antique car clubs go out there for the day, and so you can look around at antique car clubs, you can run around the countryside, you can walk down to the pond, you can play in the pond that's next to the gazebo.
This is the same pond that you were
with the sewer manure.
Just checking for that clarification. Although I think actually could people get into that pond now? They wouldn't in the old days because it was pretty unsanitary.
Better. It's better.
But
yeah,
it probably has some chemicals from the
operation. Oh, no. We completely...
There's a Caddyshack, the pool, or the pond. Pond's good for you. Okay, Representative Holvey.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I think this is, a good fit for your particular business, but I'm wondering about the statute as I'm reading it. Would this allow a wholesale distributor, manufacturer, processing, packaging, or repackaging of these agricultural crops that are produced off the farm? I'm curious, does this allow somebody to not produce anything on the farm and just completely just do wholesale distribution, manufacturing, processing without producing anything on the farm, and that opens up to any... I'm guessing in the bill that since it's not used specifically, this would apply broadly to any wholesale distribution and manufacturing packaging of raw or processed agricultural products. So you wouldn't really have to grow anything on this farmland at all, and you could just be a wholesale packaging distribution plant.
Good question. It was our intent in using the words integrated the operations be intertwined and supportive of each other, that they not be, as you're suggesting, which in some regards is allowed as a conjunctive use.
If I could add a couple of things about that. One is that it is an integrated use. The other piece is if you look at the -1 amendment, it should be in your materials, it also limits it to 100,000 square feet of space that were used for agricultural products produced on or before May 19th, 1970. So it's going to be hard to find a farm with 100,000 square feet of buildings that was in existence prior to 1970. So we have worked to try and create what is a very narrow market segment right now to keep that, because I agree. The slippery slope is an excellent argument and a destructive argument. And one of the problems we have here is if we're not careful, we get unintended consequences. And that's precisely why we've tried to approach it from that angle, so that we keep it very concise and it applies pretty close measure to this property. Frankly, I wouldn't be here if we were suggesting that anybody who wanted to do projects like this wholesale and not be using. And incidentally, I think 25% of your product is your own. Is it that high?
It's not that high.
It's not that high. But a significant portion is right there from the farm.
Yeah.
And the goal is to actually increase that, because there are surrounding derelict farms that I think offer potential for that growth. And it's pretty exciting. You know, you're talking about 25, 30, 35 jobs. That's a significant number of livable wage kinds of things.
Yeah.
And fairly steady work for the bulk of those people.
So, yeah, I can get
okay. that. And sorry, we haven't we haven't furnished the Dash ones, I don't think, to anybody yet, because we just got them in our inbox.
May I?
No, that's okay. We're email them too as well.
My apology. I thought these were added to
no, that's
record.
It's not your error.
Okay, Representative Davis.
That was my question. Is there's a mention of Dash 1, and that's not in here. But and I was also point too, as two witnesses did, to the language in at least the original, which is integrated with farm use of the property, which I think is the point you're trying to make.
Yes, and I appreciate that. Mr. Chair, thank you.
And I follow up, Mr. Chair. Well, I would just, you know, maybe ask somebody else, do we have a definition of what integrated with farm use really means?
Right, sure. Yeah, sometimes in other statutes, there's like thresholds of how much, you know, percent that is right. Farm produced versus blah, blah, blah. Farm stands, I think, have something like that. We have some agency people here we can talk to in a little bit as well. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I think in that regards, we have done what we thought was our due diligence to try and create a carefully and limited scope here in this bill. To say that, that's why we have hearings, is to find out if we did a good job or if it needs improvement. If it needs improvement, we would be thrilled to work with anybody. We'd like to get this to protect Mr. Dierking and the Lavender Farm, but we're not trying to wholesale abolish other rules and allow all kinds of things that unintended and probably undesired consequences. We support the notion that farmland needs to be used for farm purposes, but this farm has a large 100,000, over 100,000 square feet of buildings on it, and it makes sense to utilize those in this way.
Okay, we've got a few more witnesses. Any more for these nice gentlemen? Okay, thank you for coming down, and if you want to stick around in case there's something else that creeps up, we'll just be a few more minutes on this one probably. And do you want to say anything about the other bills other than we'll hear from the people you introduced them as a courtesy to? But
yes, thank you, Chair. There are two other bills here regarding surveying issues. I introduced those as a courtesy for the county. I had, since I returned in 2009, I've done that previously. We have a new county surveyor this year.
Okay.
And so.
Okay.
Okay, and so they will explain the bills.
Yeah.
And they have the expertise, which I do not, to explain those bills.
No problem.
Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, Katie, do you want to come up? And I don't know if you're bringing anybody or not, but okay.
How about you do the cleaning?
Okay, the amendment should be in your system now, too, colleagues. Welcome.
Good afternoon. Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. Farm Bureau has concerns with House Bill 3439, and the concern really stems from writing an amendment in the EFU for a permitted use for really carving out one operation and what the ramifications of that could be. These type of distribution centers really should go through the conditional use process, so transportation impacts and other off-farm use impacts can be assessed and mitigated for. You know, I believe from hearing the testimony, it seems like some of the issue is that it seems like a large portion of the operations products are coming from out of the area, even out of country, and are not being tied directly into the local agricultural community, which is what a lot of the permitting process is for, is to have that integrated so it's benefiting the local agricultural community and their economics activity. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
questions?
Okay. All right, then.
Thank you.
And that's all I've got on my list, so I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3439, and we'll move into our House Bills 3085 and 3089, the surveying bills, and hoping we have anyone to talk about at least one of them. Let's see. They asked for a little more time. I said, we don't have a lot to do, so can you at least come in and tell us about what you're trying to do, even if the amendments aren't ready? So, oh, yeah. Okay. And everybody's opposed. Is there anybody here to say anything about, about the positive aspects of the bill or why we might want them? Or no. Okay. Well, all right then. I'll just
call. You want me to try?
No. Yeah. Just let me call the post, please. All right. Sorry.
Who sponsored this bill?
Representative Cameron. Society of Duct Tape Material. I'm going to open the public hearings on House Bill 385 and 3089 and ask Mr. Chandler. That's ought to be good. And Ms. Adamson and Stephen Kafori come up.
Joe needs some water.
Would you like to look at some more rabbit renderings?
I'll sober you right up.
Here, how about the bear? Yeah.
When you were trying to decipher yesterday.
Well, until today, I thought we still had the old rule where you had to at least have a first public hearing by a certain day, and now we don't even have that rule anymore. So I thought we could at least meet the definition here while things got worked on, but that's not even required at all anymore. You don't have to ever have a public hearing on a bill, apparently, anymore. No, Mr. Chandler.
He's next door. He's right on the witness stand.
Oh. Okay.
Good place.
Mr. Rendy. Yeah, and Mr. Kafori. Yep. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Jessica Adamson. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Land Title Association.
Oh. Bob, Chandler's here. If you want, you're kind of in the neutral category, I know.
Yes, yeah. Definitely a lot funnier than Mark.
Yeah.
It's true.
Sorry about that.
We are, as you'll note, Mr. Chair, we are opposed but leaning neutral, and I would really like to get all the way over to the neutral box. Okay. This legislation for House Bill 3085, I can't speak to why this bill exists, but our client, the Oregon Land Title Association, for the most part views this as law improvement and thinks it's really a good idea. Their problem exists on page 4, line 8. That deals with how
3085 you're referring to?
Correct.
Yeah.
Page 4, line 8, which talks about if you're conveying if you're making a dedication of land for a public purpose or a public easement other than to the body that has jurisdiction over division of the land, that you have to create a separate easement. And apparently that's not currently how this is done. It's done different ways in different jurisdictions. And so we simply would like to take a must on page 8 and turn that into a may. And with we have been given an opportunity to create that amendment by Representative Kennemer. We are taking full advantage of that opportunity, and with that amendment, I will be fully in the neutral column. Thank you.
All we can ask for. Mr. Chandler, we're still looking for an in favor, but I don't think we're going to get it. So.
Mr. Chair, member of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builder Association, here emphatically meh about House Bill 3085, which I would recommend to staff adding that column to the sign-up sheet. Okay. Would be very helpful for some of us.
for you.
I'm not entirely sure, as Ms. Adamson mentioned, I'm not sure exactly where this bill came from. We have two problems to get us fully to meh on this one. One is on, Ms. Adams already mentioned, on page 4, line 8, same exact problem of changing must to may, or if it ain't too much trouble, or some other equal variation. And on page 2, line 36, a more substantive concern, what this does, this language actually on lines 32 through 36 of page 2 defines a tract. Tract has, as the dark print indicates, is not defined in Oregon law currently. It has been used somewhat flexibly over the years to primarily define lots. A lot is a lot of land is often referred to as a tract of land. This definition, which may be a perfectly fine one if line 36 is excised, causes this problem because line 36 says a tract, blah, 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 may not be used for purposes such as residential dwellings or commercial buildings, which conceivably would allow somebody by creation of a tract to essentially adopt a land use action by simply creating a tract, thereby making it off limits for residential or commercial use, which is usually the subject of a great deal of planning expense and headache and luba trips and whatnot. So much as we might think that luba trips and avoiding planning expense is a good idea, probably doing it with the definition in a bill like this isn't the right thing to do. That one, I think, was probably inadvertent. I don't know of anybody who would want to allow that to happen just by virtue of the property owner's whim, but that is a real concern the way that particular section is drafted. Those two changes, Mr. Chairman, and we happily go back to sleep.
Okay. Mr. Kafouri.
Chair, I've been lobbying this building since 1985, and this is the first time I've ever been able to sit up in front of a committee and argue against the bill and have nobody speaking in favor of it. I've got some problems with the bill. I represent the American Planning Association, Oregon chapter, which is land use planners in the state and land use lawyers.
Can you state your name for the record?
Oh, I'm sorry, Stephen Kafouri. I almost feel like sitting down, but I get paid for doing this, Mr. Right, Chair. I got to call my clients and say it was really tough, but I convinced them. I convinced them this is a bad idea. We're concerned about the definition of tract as well. Bottom line, the bill I've sent you an email that has the details of what our concerns are. If anybody thinks this is something, there's a problem out there to be resolved, we'd be happy to join them and see if we can't work something out. But in the absence of anybody showing us that their problem needs to be resolved, I would suggest you do no further with either one of these two bills.
Sorry. Okay, any questions for the people on the bill?
We're going to move it?
Is this why we're... Yeah. We're ready to go. We got the paperwork. Okay.
Is there written testimony in support of it? In OLA?
No. No.
Yeah, there is.
Yes.
There is.
Oh, sorry.
Chair, like read it out loud. There is some background information.
Do you know who sent that?
Yes.
It's a blank piece of paper.
Representatives of the county surveyor. I know. Okay. Yes, but they were going to testify today on that, and things changed for
them. To be fair, they asked for some more time. I needed to at least have a first public hearing by a certain date. Told them no, more time. So this is definitely in part my fault for... but I still thought somebody might come to talk about it. So on the next one, we have somebody in favor of it. So that's on 3089. So we'll have that in a moment. Okay, thank you. And Mr. Rindy.
I missed this.
Yeah, he's the one in favor.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'll be very brief. I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I've sent you a letter. It's probably too detailed for me to spend a lot of time on it, and I don't think that's necessary. I just want to make sure it was clear. One, we are not opposing this bill, but we think that the issue, in fact, probably needs some attention. We think the way that this has been done should be adjusted, and would wanted to make sure that if indeed you are going to keep working on this, or the committee wants to, that we would like to be part of that group. We've noted for the record that, as others have, that the definition of tract is a problem, not the least of which is the term is already defined in a very closely related statute in 215. And 215, in fact, incorporates definitions in 92 by reference. So by defining this term differently in 92, you're going to incorporate in 215 two conflicting definitions. That's this little stuff. I think it all can be fixed, and we would like to be part of a group to do that, and that's just an example. So with that, I'll be happy to answer questions.
Can you just tell us what the whole thing's about in the first place? Because we're down to amendments because nobody's here to give the normal backstory. So what in the world are we talking about here?
So for a very long time, I think the early Pleistocene, the surveyors have been using the term tract as plats are created. And for a good example would be condominiums, where there's an open space, commonly held open space area. But for other kinds of use situations where it's generally open space, surveyors have been using this term tract on those recorded plats and without authorization in statute. And you're very quickly way beyond my area of expertise when you start getting into surveying and plats. But my understanding is that because this has gone on for so long, there are countless recorded plats, plats that use the term tract. I'm sorry if I've mixed those up. And the term tract, as surveyors use it, is, I think, I understand, there's been an attempt here to reflect that in the drafting of this, but this is sort of a long-standing common understanding rather than something that's actually been written down over these years in the subdivision law.
Okay. We are going to send you off with the anonymous person who wrote this piece of paper once I figure out who they are into a room, and you guys can come up with some things. Sure. Representative Davis.
Thank you. You said tract is defined elsewhere.
Yes.
Do you know what that definition is? Because this written testimony says tract is not defined in Oregon law. Apparently that's incorrect.
I think that's incorrect, and that's not our testimony. I don't know if we cite directly to it, but we do indicate in our letter that the definition in ORS 215 is that a tract is one or more contiguous lots or parcels under the same ownership. So that's a definition I think developed around 91, 92 in conjunction with, at the time, we were doing a lot of things that had to do with high-value farmland and some other things. So I think the surveyors would be right if they said we were there first, mm-hmm. because it certainly preceding that, there were many plats that used this term, but it was not formally in statute.
Yeah, follow up. And the problem I see is, I've seen a whole lot of plats that use the term tract where I don't think a tract is dedicated to a public open space. I think there actually are residential dwellings on it, condominiums on it. There might be tract 1, 2, 3, 4, and there are things on it. Because tract, to follow up Mr. Chandler's testimony, I think tract has generally been used, at least in my law practice, as a general phrase. Surveyors may be attempting to say, no, we want to use our. Anyway. Without them here, it's a mystery.
Okay. All right. So
we have a name, though. Carl.
That's all I got on House Bill 3085. We'll revisit that another day. We'll close the public hearing, House Bill 3085. I think I already opened it on 3089, so I could take Mr. Kafori's testimony. You're welcome to come back up on that. Let me get the other people up here first, though, because I've got you on the bottom of that list. Right. Scott Freshwaters, Matt Dunkel, and Michael Morrissey. Did I already open it on 38? I did it together, but yeah. I was laughing so hard I couldn't help it.
It's okay. We got it.
Okay.
There he is again.
Okay, Scott. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, excuse me, my name is Scott Freshwaters. I'm a professional land surveyor. I live in the Sun River area, and I've been surveying now for approximately 35 years. And you have my half of my written testimony. It's entitled Boundary Line Agreements, House Bill 3089, has my name on it. And
starts out with what is a boundary line agreement and why is legislation required. I'm not going to go over that at this time for brevity's sake. But I would like to drop down on the first page and read, starting the third section from the bottom, where I say, so, since the Oregon courts, along with most other states, have given property owners the right to this type of agreement, what is the justification for this legislation? Well, there are many reasons, but two exigent reasons are that in at least two Oregon counties, namely Deschutes and Washington, the county clerk will not record a document entitled Boundary Line Agreements. This fact has caused documents to be recorded that contain conveyance language, which, if legally challenged, could conceivably negate the boundary line agreement. The other reason is closely tied to the first, namely, to require that an agreement be entered into the public record. This requirement can serve the purpose to obviate the need for future spiteful and vexatious litigation and to place any successive purchaser on notice of the agreement. Another benefit of this legislation is the requirement that the agreed upon line be monumented by a surveyor along with the survey map of the agreement being filed in the Office of County Surveyor. The boundary line agreement is not a one-size-fits-all remedy. As you can see, it is very specific in its application and should not be entered into lightly. But if all of the elements are satisfied, it is a very equitable way of fixing an uncertain or disputed boundary and can potentially save some property owners tens of thousands of dollars in legal fees. I won't get into the statute of frauds. Some of you, maybe all of you, know what the statute of frauds is. If not, the explanation is right there.
I have no idea.
Okay.
So I was looking for company. Maybe Mr. Davis does.
No. Would you like me to go over the statute of frauds? I'll make it brief.
Sure, yeah.
Thank you, Chair Clem.
Sounds interesting.
Chair Clem and committee members, statute of frauds goes back into English common law, and it basically states that any transfer of real property must be in writing. Well, then, if two coterminous property owners are entering into this agreement, that their line is here, how does that not violate the statute of frauds? Well, the courts, Oregon courts specifically, have answered that question, and they say that the reason that an oral agreement that meets these requirements, meaning the requirements that I spelled out at the beginning of this testimony, written testimony, I didn't go over those elements. The reason that an oral agreement that meets these requirements does not violate the statute is that it interprets rather than alters the property deed description and therefore does not affect a conveyance or transfer of real property. That's from Hammock versus Olds, 93 Oregon Court of Appeals, 161, 1988 case. And then the third and fourth pages of my first part of my testimony shows a couple of situations that I've come across in my private land surveying practice where there could possibly be a boundary line agreement, but I talked to my client about that possibility in both of these situations, and they said, well, just survey it according to the deed. So you're seeing the results of what surveying the deed does. In the first page, it should be the first page of my two survey examples, there, the line that I surveyed cuts through a garage, whereby there's a fence that's approximately, I don't see the distance on there, but maybe 30 feet to the west that been there a long time. And then on the second page of those two survey examples, you'll see fences that are very similar as the previous one, only there aren't any structures that are impacted by my surveying the line according to the deed.
Now, the other part of my testimony is proposed amendments to House Bill 3089, which unfortunately did not come out of Legislative Council as of the time of this hearing. And there this bill has been very controversial in the surveying community. And the main cause of heartburn, if you will, associated with this bill is the first iteration, we had a requirement in there that county surveyors would certify that all the elements of the law were complied with. Well, after conferring with the OASIS, the Oregon Association of County Engineers and Surveyors, and other concerned parties, that is the major amendment to this bill. And I did pass out proposed amendments to the bill, and all these, like I said, are in Legislative Council as we speak. They just haven't been released yet. And really, that's all the testimony I have. So thank you, Chair Clem, and members of the committee for this opportunity. Are there any questions?
We'll just go through that. Actually, yeah, any questions for Mr. Freshwaters? You may be our only proponent on either bill, so as we're thankful you came.
Thank you.
Representative Holby.
Thanks. I can appreciate the issue, the boundary line by agreements. I'm wondering what happens in a situation where the there isn't necessarily an agreement, but there's discovered an inaccuracy that's actually recorded on the deed, simply that the measurements don't add up. You've got a, let's say, a tract of land where you've got 12 lots and they all say they're this size and they're all recorded in a deed, but when you add them all up physically with a new survey, there's not that much space there. What happens when there's no agreement?
That's a very good question, Representative.
Because I've noticed most people just ignore it and hope it goes away.
Yeah, but the problem is it doesn't, of course, as we know, and Representative Holby, Chair, members of the committee. Yeah, there are various ways to deal with it, and if a land surveyor does get involved in a situation like that, we look at a lot of different factors. The possession lines, for example, in my testimony, those fence lines, if we're doing the job that we should be doing, we're going to be interviewing the adjoiners to the property we're surveying, and we may try to go back in time and interview previous owners to find out how old the fence is. What do people think about it? Have you considered that your property line, or is that just a fence of convenience? If they've considered it a their property line, it's been there for a long time, there could be the element of what's called acquiescence involved. And that may be their property line now. Or there's another possible remedy would be going through the land use process and doing property line adjustments to fix a problem like that. There are a lot of tools that surveyors have in our toolbox, and a boundary line agreement is just another one of those tools that we would like to see legislated. Right now, adjoining property owners, as I mentioned in my testimony, have the right to enter into a boundary line agreement without involving a surveyor. But that can cause a lot of problems, and that's why people have spent $50,000-$60,000 carrying a dispute to the Oregon Appellate Court, because some predecessor in time did not document that boundary line agreement. Now there's a dispute over it, whereas if it was documented, then there's no question, and why go litigate over it?
Representative Davis.
Sure. this opens up a real can of worms, because there are multiple situations that dealt with here. One type of situation is where truly, let's just talk about two property owners believe that, and let's talk about a single fence, truly believe that that fence is the property line, it's always been the property line, and whoops, the deeds going back historically, actually it was, usually we're talking about 5 feet, 6 feet over. But then that's the problem, is sometimes one property owner says, oh, my property is actually 6 feet over, and I want that property, and I want you to move your fence. That's why we have adverse possession claims. That's why we have acquiescence claims. If you can prove you've had that boundary for over 10 years, generally you have a valid adverse possession claim. So it's a good question, Representative Holvey, and it's difficult to answer because the reason for so much litigation in this area is each circumstance can be different. Washington State does allow boundary line agreements, mm-hmm. although I would take issue that the submitted testimony says that this is not a conveyance of land. Actually, it is a conveyance of land, and that's the point, is the previous deeds of conveyance were incorrect in their meets and bounds description of the land, and if the two parties agree that that should be corrected to where that fence actually is, then it is a conveyance. And so the way we deal with this with a lot of our clients is simply by deed. And a county will usually do have to run that deed through the planning department because you are changing lot lines to make sure it conforms with planning. So this isn't unusual. This is used in many, many states as another method of conveyance. The problem with just doing it by deed is only a single person can sign the deed, usually the grantor. And the boundary line agreement, for example, used in Washington, is essentially a deed where both parties say, here's the history of what happened. I'm going to deed this property so we can line it up with the fence, and we're both going to sign it so that the record reflects that we both agree this is where it is. So it is a valuable tool in the state of Washington, I know. And I can appreciate some counties in Oregon do allow these to be recorded and some don't, simply because the law is not clear in the statutes as to whether or not we can record these.
If I may, Representative Davis, members of the committee, I respect that you are well-versed in the law, sir, but for my understanding of it and reading through more than 10 appellate court cases, one Supreme Court case, what I'm getting out of what I have studied here is that this does not convey land. It just interprets the party's deed as to where the line is. And that's almost verbatim out of the courts. I have it back here. I could read it from numerous Oregon court cases, language with words to that effect. So and don't get me wrong, there are many surveyors that think exactly like you do, that it does convey land, but a pure boundary line agreement has nothing to do with title. It's not a title issue. It's just fixing the line where the deeds say it is, but the reason it's being done is because either there's ambiguities in the deeds, and you give the deeds to two different surveyors, they're going to come up with two different locations for the line, and that would be called objective uncertainty.
Good example.
And so you have two deeds. You can't survey it. You can't put the line in just one place. So the owners have come to an agreement and said, well, this fence has been here for a long time. That's where we agreed upon the line to be. We don't know where it really is. And they have that right. Again, to do that without involving a surveyor and even without recording any kind of agreement with the county clerk. But there again, that can cause a myriad of problems in the future when it's not documented.
Okay. Representative Holvey.
Thanks. I mean, I can understand how this works on maybe one line, you know, but if that one line is then, you know, used as that boundary line and then is measured over from the deed and say, let's say it was 5 feet off, and
that means you need a boundary agreement for the line on the other side of you. If you're keeping the accuracy of what your deed says your property size is, and so now you have another boundary agreement for that line and another one, and pretty soon somebody's going to be impacted and end up 5 feet short, and they may not be in agreement with that boundary line agreement by the time it gets to them, and that first one may have impacted that property down the road. So, you know, I guess that's kind of my concern about establishing boundary line agreements as the actual line. Does it actually impact, you know, surrounding properties in the whole tract of land?
Representative Pulvey and members of the committee, conceivably it could. I won't deny that. As a matter of fact, there's a section of land, a square mile, if you will, northwest of Lapine, where, and one of these examples I have in my testimony came out of that, where the fences, I don't care what survey monument you start with, how you survey it, you cannot get, using the monuments around that section, you cannot get the deed description to fit those possession lines. And the county surveyor, Deschutes County Surveyor Mike Berry, is well aware of this problem. They've even had a public hearing on it. The issue is, how do you fix something like that? And that serves to actually prove your point. Yeah, you have all these lines, these fences and driveways, structures built, and people have always thought, assumed that these were their property lines, but a surveyor can't take their deed and have it match these possession lines. And if you had everybody go through the boundary line agreement process, but one of them says, hey, I'm losing 5 feet that I thought I had, yeah, it can throw a wrench in the whole works. I would concede that.
Representative Davis.
Thanks. And I would just add that this is trying to address a situation where you do have agreement. That's the point of a boundary line agreement. If there's a dispute as to two or three property owners who don't want to concede where that line is, then you're not going to have those property owners sign that agreement, and they're going to go into litigation or adverse possession claims or another route. This is, at least in Washington, speaking from my experience there, is for situations where you have two or three or four property owners who are choosing to mutually come to an agreement as opposed to litigation. Right. And this is an avenue used in other states to make that possible.
Correct, Representative Davis and members of the committee. Yeah, that's RCW 50.05 or something mm-hmm. like that. I've read that statute. And it's attractive, to be honest with you, in that it's a lot simpler than mm-hmm. what we have here. But here in Oregon, we're bound to the verbiage that comes out of the Legislative Council's office. So we really can't, it doesn't appear that we can simplify like they did up in Washington State. One other thing, that if I
and
may.
I should take some other testimony from the gentleman sitting next to you, maybe, and then we'll come back if we have any more questions.
Okay.
Because they've been there for a while.
Sure,
so welcome.
Thank you.
My name is Matt Dunkel. I'm a private surveyor of Yamhill County. Been in business for myself since 1981. As Mr. Freshwater says, there's a lot of controversy over this bill in the surveying community. And I think my main objection to the bill, the amendment that was proposed, relieves a lot of it, but this is all a legal process. When we do a survey, we have a problem with the deeds. The neighbors can either agree or they can't agree. We have to notify everybody that we're out there. We have a problem with a line that doesn't look right. A boundary line agreement, when you get two neighbors together, is the best possible of all solutions for a surveyor. So by the time we come to that fact, both parties are talking, and we don't practice law as private surveyors. We measure, and we try to interpret the deeds and put the lines on the ground. That's all we do. So get two neighbors talking together. They want to agree on a line. They need legal representation. We don't prepare the documents. The attorneys do. So for us, it's an easy solution. We don't have any problem with it. And most of my friends that I talk to just say, why is this bill needed? Because it seems to us that all it takes is a process that we have to go through anyway, and then we have inserted the county surveyor into the situation. By the time we do a survey, we find a problem, we have the neighbors talking, then their attorneys have been talking, they prepare the documents, we do a survey drawing and we submit it to the county. That's when the county surveyor knows about it. But by that time, we already have the agreement. So I guess my objection is that I don't understand why we have to have a county surveyor inserted into the problem.
Great. Okay, Michael.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. My name is Michael Morrissey. I'm a policy staff for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. I did submit very brief testimony, which I hope you'll accept basically as a marker. We weren't really a party to kind of where this problem came from or what the right solution might be. And as I said in the letter, in land use regs, there's a lot line adjustment process, which includes criteria for when a lot line might get moved in terms of what might happen in terms of non-conforming lots or allowing dwellings to be built. So what we say here basically is we're not yet sure that there isn't kind of an overlying Venn diagram between what's trying to be done here and land use opportunities or outcomes. I think at least at first, and having talked to some staff representing counties, we're not entirely comfortable that this process doesn't involve in some way county planning staff. There doesn't appear to be, although evidently this most often involves a slight disagreement one way or the other about the amount of land. Nonetheless, there's no real clear definition of how far you might wind up agreeing that this boundary moves. And again, there could be some land use implications in that. So it looks that there's a lot of parties who think there needs more work to be done, and we want to be part of that team on behalf of the land use program. And I assume that there'll be some local jurisdictions that may want to be part of that as well. Thank you.
Okay, questions for these other two folks? Representative Davis.
Thank you, Chair. Apologies. This is an area of interest to me. I guess I appreciate the comment about what problem are we trying to solve, because I've never had an issue with a county in doing this for my clients. I usually go to the county website. The planning department has their own process that they laid out for a boundary line adjustment. I call the planner. We discuss the issues. We hire a surveyor. We usually do a deed or two. Sometimes we record a boundary line agreement, and it works. Washington has a more formal boundary line agreement process, so I'd just be interested in what problem are we trying to solve? Because I know this exact legislation has been introduced now a few sessions in a row.
Well, Rob Davis, I'm not sure if that's for me. I agree with everything
anybody
you said.
Anybody up there, yeah.
Like I say, we weren't really part of the discussion that caused this thing to emerge in the first place.
Yeah.
So.
If I may, Representative Davis and members of the committee, first off, Mr. Morrissey stated that they have the property line adjustment process, which sounds more like what you're speaking of, Representative Davis, provides for a lot line to be moved. Well, I would agree. The property line adjustment has a known line, and because there was a structure built too close to the line or for whatever reason, by following the land use process and the county ordinances, you can move a line for convenience sake under again, the jurisdiction of the planners and meeting all the zoning setback requirements, et cetera, et cetera. The boundary line agreement does not move a property line. It just fixes it where the people have title to, and it's done because the deeds, again, are ambiguous or there's some other uncertainty about where the line is. It's not moving a thing. It may cause the line to differ from where the county cartographer shows it on the assessor's maps. That I would concede. But that could be a result of the county cartographer using his best guess mm-hmm. as to what the deed says or his interpretation of the deed or so, deeds.
Chair.
Yeah.
Question.
Follow up.
Thank you. I think that clarifies. I think the problem we're talking about then is not necessarily movement of a fence when the deed is clear as to where the boundary line is, but you are specifically talking about meets and bounds that do not close, for example.
Exactly.
Or where it's an old deed and we're talking about it's 75 feet down the large rock. I mean, literally, deeds will say this, down a large rock next to the creek, and two reasonable surveyors will disagree. That's the situation we're trying to remedy here.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you, Representative Davis.
Okay, so in that respect, I think that the illustrations you provided are not entirely on point because these illustrate deeds, lines that go through garages, things like that, but we're talking about really where the deeds are unclear as to where that line really is, and the parties have come to mutual agreement as to where it historically should be.
Well, if I may, Representative Davis, and committee members, what I was trying to show with those is fences that have been there a long, long time.
Right.
And I didn't interview the adjoiners or their predecessors in time to find out what they thought about those fences. But it's just obvious that people have thought that that's where their lines were. So maybe there was some kind of agreement, or maybe I don't know how those fences came to be there. But if you look at the shape, if you just shifted it over where I surveyed it according to mm-hmm. the deeds, it would almost be a perfect fit. So it may have been a situation where possibly there was a boundary line agreement, but there is one little interesting fact about surveying that not a lot of people know, is when we set a monument, a pin, rebar, pipe, whatever you want to call it, that's our opinion of where the line is,
right,
or the corner is. We don't have the authority to make it so, though. If the adjoining owners honor that monument and the line that is established by it, that is the boundary. But just because we set a pin in the ground as a surveyor doesn't make it so.
Interesting. Oh. Representative Pulvey?
Sure. Just a quick follow-up. Sorry. This is right in the wheelhouse. This is fun for me.
Now I know why you're on this committee.
I've keyed in. I think the issue really is where we have meets and bounds that don't close, just by example, in a deed. And the problem we would attempt to solve there is that currently the process to solve that is twofold, either a quiet title action, a lawsuit.
105.
Right.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. And the second is some counties are allowing recording of a boundary line agreement already because they recognize this, and some don't. So in those counties that don't recognize this, really the only way to remedy that situation is to file a quiet title lawsuit because you have to get something in the record recorded by the county court that says, we've looked at all the historical circumstances and we agree that fence is the intended property line. Anyway.
Representative Holby.
I'm not sure if Representative Davis just answered my question, but maybe I'll ask it anyway, and you can tell me if you answered it. So I can appreciate, you know, the meets and bounds don't close because of the description that, you know, down yonder by the rock, then turn left, you know, and all that stuff. But, I mean, I think in my past life, I've run into some issues where they actually give you measurements and, you know, headings, and you go out there, mm-hmm. and
you find that spot. But right. When you come back from the other direction, that spot's not in the same place. They're in different places. And so my question is, if you decide in that scenario where you don't have the ambiguity, but there's actually an inaccuracy, you know, recorded in the deeds, you know, when you do the whole tract or plat or whatever, and it's not accurate because in the 1940s and 50s they didn't quite have the same instrumentation to make accurate measurements up and down hills. So what happens if you have a boundary agreement then between two neighbors? We call it good. I come along as a new buyer. I hire a better surveyor than you that comes over and says, no, actually this line's over here. And I'm going to say to the owner that was party of that old boundary agreement, I say, hey, you got to move your fence. It's on my property. So does that boundary line agreement that was entered into by the past people now change that deed that this person just bought? And does it stand up? Is it passed on? That's, I guess, what my question is.
Representative Holvey, members of the committee. First, you did mention when you started this hypothetical that there was a monument in the ground. Well, it's...
Well, not necessarily.
Well, okay, but let's see. If there is a monument in the ground and it has been honored by adjoining owners, that's pretty good evidence that that's where the line is, number one. Or if a monument is called for in the deed, even though the measurements don't take you to that monument is controlling the boundary. The other item you mentioned is, again, if there's no written boundary line agreement, there's no documentation of it, that is the very reason why we have these Oregon appellate court cases. If we had this process today that I'm a proponent of, and if this was enacted into law, there is language in the bill that says, I believe, heirs and assigns. So it, once the agreement is entered into and recorded, it's a forever agreement.
That answers my question. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Oh, sorry. Vice Chair Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Freshwaters, for your detailed testimony. And it's not often that I get free counsel from attorneys and surveyors. On a piece of property, this is interesting, a piece of property they recently purchased, there's a fence that I believe the previous owners of the property I had put up, but now I've got a pin in the ground that's about this far inside that fence on my line, and then the property owner next to me says, you want to move your fence?
Hmm.
And I say, no, it's your fence. It's on your property. You can move it if you want.
Yeah.
Mr. Attorney.
It's a legal standing here. Mr. Surveyor, because there's a pin in the ground now that I say when I bought the property, that was where the property was. He agrees that that's the property line.
Okay. Well, in Vice Chair Cameron, members of the committee, and Representative Davis, you may be able to expand on this a little bit or even correct me, but in Oregon there is a law that deals with fences and the movement of fences. And the person who has a fence that is, let's say, encroaching, I'm kind of loath to use that word because it does have legal connotations, but everybody understands I'm not using it in a legal sense, but a fence that is encroaching on your property, then there's a year period that the, how's that work? I think you have a year, or the owner has a year to move it, and if they don't move it in that year period, you have the right to remove it from your property. I think that's how that works. Is that correct, Representative Davis, or are you aware of that law?
Well, I wasn't going to go down that route. If I happen to be assisting Representative Cameron in this situation, which I am not giving legal advice right now, It's that if you're saying that the fence is on your property,
Mr. Chair, I'm good. I got my question answered. Okay. In fact, I'll get free legal advice, and I know what free legal advice is worth. It's it's worth what you pay for.
Okay. Thank you for helping us understand the pros and cons of this bill. Yeah. And wow. Mr. Kafoury, did you want to come back up on this one? Okay, let's have Mr. Kafoury wrap it up here for us today.
Thank you.
In the Land Use Committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Stephen Kafoury. I represent the Oregon chapter of the American Planning Association. We agree that there is a problem that needs to be resolved. We'd like to help make this bill work. I have a number of technical issues. If you look, I sent you an email with the, our concerns. Rather than go through them in detail, you can read them as well as I can. I don't understand what they mean anyway. I mean, this is, as you can appreciate, I think, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I can, for sure. It's probably a work stuff. Group with Mr. Yeah. Davis, Mr. Morrissey, one of your clients, maybe Mr. Holvey and Mr. Freshwaters.
Like bottom line is there are some problems in this bill, technical problems. There is a problem that needs to be resolved. We'd like to be, I assure you, not I, would be involved. Somebody from our my association would be happy to help work on this.
Okay. Great. Any questions for Mr. Kafoury or comment?
I'm not getting answered.
Just five or six.
Yeah. Just, I have a list of detailed questions in my file, but I can't find it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Kafoury. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bills, House Bill 3089. Anything else for the good of the order? Good job on the House Land Use Committee.